We have a couple of precious full days of practice ahead of us. It can be tempting to think, yeah, but we've got more behind us and it's finishing and I've got all this other stuff to do, but you know, you've given it such a long run up, and now these last couple of precious days can be days of significant fruiting. Or even just support to keep the momentum going. So we have this container, don't we? And let us keep the container intact. Yeah. The noble silence, the gift we give each other. We don't enter into each other's silence uninvited. We're keeping things safe and conducive for one another. And for ourselves, keeping needless distractions to a minimum if you can for the next couple of days, and you may be surprised at what results, pleasantly surprised, by the way. And this notion of that awareness comes first, of course, it doesn't mean it wins the prizes. It comes first, not second or third. It's that in every moment, attention is always primarily with awareness. It's first in every moment. That's how we build the path. And we know from our experience here together and work you've done elsewhere that in this space of awareness, the work can be done, or the fun, depending on how you look at it. We can see forms, physical forms, as just forms, or to refer to that sutta we heard yesterday, Fena Sutta, we can see form as just like foam. You know, a lump of foam on the water, it looks three-dimensional, it looks solid, but it's mostly air. It doesn't last. And we can see form in that way. We can see form externally, internally that way. We can see form in the past, forms in the present, and any forms in any future will all have this characteristic, like foam, like a lump of foam. In the bigger scheme of things, no more substantial than that. And what is that? How can that be? How can a big lump of iron be like a lump of foam? Well, give it a few eons, it won't survive, one thing. But what they share also is an inherent insubstantiality. Sometimes the word used is emptiness. Emptiness of what you might be able to call a self. If you take up Carol's car from the other day, she's using the car as an example. It's a coming together of causes and conditions, a car. It's somehow the wheels and the this and the that, the gas tank, the gas, the whole thing, boom, can get you somewhere, it can move, right? Same with a plane, a rocket. But they don't have to invent a self. They don't have to say, a car doesn't have to go, oh my God, I've got to look after myself or I'll rust. Or there's no self needed. It's a coming together of causes and conditions that works for a while. In that sense, it's empty. It's empty of existence on its own side. It didn't manifest, I'm a car, hi. You know, it didn't just self-manifest. It's a coming together of causes and conditions. And as we know, conditions arise, there for a while, and they pass. We know this in awareness. When we're not aware, we forget. We ignore this reality, don't we? So in awareness we can see form as just form, not a self. It's not me or mine, therefore. or you or yours. We can see feelings similarly. It's like bubbles on the water from that sutta. They bubble up, they're insubstantial, and they're gone. They might keep bubbling up a lot and a lot and a lot, but when we see them in their reality, they cease to fascinate in the same way, and the clinging doesn't happen. The clinging happens because we're fascinated, either horrified fascinated or delighted fascinated, but nonetheless in the grip of. And so with the other khandhas, the other factors that combine to form what we call ourself, form, feeling, perceptions. In awareness, we can see perceptions like a mirage. Take a look at something like this. And through my history of living in a world that has glasses or cups, the perception is glass or cup. That's not necessarily right or wrong, good or bad. It's a perception. But we know what happens to perceptions. Perceptions are really tricky, and it's really worth paying attention to perceptions. Has anyone here ever been to a dentist? My guess is yes, quite a lot of people have been to a dentist. Root canal, something like that. How are you feeling? Were you maybe a little bit anxious? A little bit apprehensive? And then you get in there and you're on that sort of recliner chair. I don't know whether they want to make you think you're at the beach or something, but there's bright lights and sunglasses. You have to trade the glasses that you can actually see for these horrid things that are scratched and don't fit. And then, boop, they go on. And then you sort of, you're reclining back. Right? And you look up. Now, this didn't happen as a kid, but at some point this trend developed, I guess, because you look up, you have your sunglasses and your bright lights, and then you see on the ceiling there an image. Someone's painted an image on the ceiling. You ever seen that at a dentist?
Yeah.
And you look up. And what do you perceive, right? There's some colour, there's some shape. And if you maintain attention, it starts to form into something recognisable. In this case, as I recall, a seascape. So you really are at the beach now. You're lying back, kicking back, bright lights, sunglasses, the sea. All admittedly slightly disorienting. And so perception, right there, no problem in awareness. But if there's not awareness, if there's just a little bit more anxiety than awareness happening at this moment, and you look up at this seascape, you start to notice it's quite psychedelic. The colours are very vibrant, very interconnected, very strange colours. Psychedelic seascape. And then you think, laughing gas. That's all that dental anesthetic. These creatures are high. And so you're lying there looking up. You look a little bit closer, and that's when you notice it. Sea slug, sea snails. These creatures have no teeth. So this initially happy little seascape seen through your sunglasses as you recline, these creatures start to look a bit smug and gloating because they don't have any problem being at this dentist. They don't have teeth. So any assumption that there might have been empathy, that's gone. There's just these smug, psychedelic sea creatures on the ceiling. And then you realise someone actually intended this. They put this up there to distract you from what they're going to do to you in this chair. Right? How are you feeling? Better or worse? Right? A little bit more anxious. And that's probably been about literally 2 to 3 mind moments. Started a bit anxious, looked up, now very anxious. And nothing's happened yet. The dentist hasn't touched you. But that distraction, unless you're about 4 or 5 or 6, when you're quite happy to go away with a fantasy, that distraction brings attention to what you need a distraction from. It's not the same thing as seeing things as they are, right? Seeing things as they are brings coolness, doesn't it? Haven't you noticed that when you're in awareness? Even if it's not fun to sit with anger, shock, numbness, desire, worry, confusion. They're not fun things to look at, but even as they're present, when we're in awareness, we see that they're impermanent. And right there we start to get a taste of release. So seeing things as they are tends to work better than distraction. Distraction's all right for a little bit, a little light relief. I remember when I just started to practice Buddhism and I'd started to do chanting. Was a little bit unusual at the beginning, sitting there chanting in Pali and not really understanding it. But, you know, you give yourself to it, and I loved the resonance of it. I loved the rhythm and the resonance and the way it brought the Sangha together in a kind of unified voice, what we were reciting, how it had been being recited by Buddhists all around the world for millennia, you know, the sense of really being hooked into lineage and practice. So I found, and I wanted the translations as well, so I actually understood what I was chanting. So not long after I'd started, I had to go. This time it was to the hospital for some surgery. So there were some painful sensations, and then there was the anticipation of further painful sensations. So I found myself, at some point I'd been put in some flimsy gown, not of my choosing, and one of those silly kind of shower cap things on your head. And I'd been put on a trolley and wheeled along the kind of conveyor belt lined up for surgery. And at some point, the very lovely nurse who'd got me to that point had to go away, and I found myself lying there, and I had a moment to contemplate what was coming next. And unfortunately, I have quite a visual imagination. And so the very thought of surgery brings very sharp knives into my peripheral vision and so on. And so there was a little bit of anxiety. So I'm lying there on the gurney or the trolley, and I'd been fairly new to Buddhism, and what came to mind was the refuge. There's this refuge. Right? And I guess I had enough need and desperation, because I was wanting not to be there. And so I started to go through the chanting in my mind, in my heart, letting it wash through the body. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Again and again, at the refuge, buddhang saranam gacchami, dhammang saranam gacchami, sanghang saranam gacchami, and the reflections, such as we do, the morning reflections. And, you know, this wasn't a consciously skillful means. This was grabbing onto what was at hand that would help. And I started to feel this cool relief wash through the body. Not cool like the cold discomfort of lying in a flimsy gown on a trolley kind of cool. This was a deeper, like a cooling of the nervous system. This loving sort of stroking touch through the cells almost. And this lightness started to take hold. And it was simply an act of desperation and an act of conviction. I guess enough faith in this, enough awe actually, the awe that I felt, especially as a young Buddhist, a new Buddhist, this path has been discovered, uncovered. There is a refuge. There is a refuge, and there's a way. And there's enough people, and enough really impressive people, I thought at that time, who who are doing this, who are practicing this, and it just brought such ease. And of course, the agitation of the clinging to my imagination, my perceptions and thought formations, all of that settled for a while. And cessation right there, just in that moment like we've all experienced this week at moments. And then there was space for something else other than anxiety and fantasies of pain and knives and the grievous bodily harm that happens to you in a surgical room. You know, they'd be arrested for it if they did it to you out in the street, right? The anesthetics and medical structure around you, that's a very different thing. So instead of all of that going on, I had gratitude. Gratitude could start to arise for the very kind, beautiful nurse that had got me to this point, for the anaesthetist who was about to take the pain away in this procedure, for the surgeon, for all of the people in that team who were there to make this happen so that the disease process in the body stops for a while. And it was just a very helpful and interesting little experiment. A little bit of chanting to myself quietly on a trolley until I got trundled off. And it made all the difference in the world. We have this refuge, we have this awareness. And when awareness comes first, the path reveals itself. Now the trick with the path is, unlike these very beautiful forest paths out here that I've been hopping around on, enjoying the moss and counting up and down the steps sometimes and looking at the beautiful sort of trajectory, the vanishing point of paths, they're visible, they're measurable, they're tangible. With this path, it's almost more, Carol and I were joking the other day, it's almost more like the eightfold neural path. It's like neural pathways are being changed. Although the steps have been beautifully taught by the Buddha and practiced by the Buddha and practiced by many, many people before us and contemporary with us, it's just not so easy to see it in the same way, is it? Or to recognize, I can't say, well, I've taken 15 steps, I've got another 10 to go. Or 99 steps, one left. Or one step, 999 to go. We can't know, can we? It's more like the path. The closest I've seen to it in pictorial terms is actually in an Indiana Jones movie. I do remember one, and all I remember about it is this particular piece. At some point, he's up on a very, very high side of a ravine. Boom, this massive drop beneath. And there's the other side, right over there, with no bridge. And of course, he has to get to the other side. Everything depends on it. And he has absolute conviction that he needs to get to the other side. So faith, if you like, the first of the spiritual faculties. Yeah? Conviction. And he has some learning. Yeah, has some teachings, and he has a clue. There's some riddle he's been given, and now he has to use all that he's got, his wits, muster all his energy, his effort. He has to put all that together and his discernment and choose the right places to step. Only all there is air and this massive drop. So this, he's got nowhere else to turn, so he has to actually spell out the word Jehovah, actually, is what it has to do. But there's nothing visible. It only appears when he steps off the edge of the present moment, takes a step forward, boom, puts the foot down. As he puts the foot down, the path appears. There's a place for him to put his foot. Then he has to discern, make the right decision, absolutely aware, takes the next step, boom. The stone beneath him appears, and on he goes like this, with nothing but the faith and conviction and all of the, well, they're not nothing, are they? All of this that he has to muster from within, and he gets his way across to the other side. The path disappears. It's not a solid, visible path. It can feel a bit like that. to me anyway, a sense of really no moment to moment what's going to pop up. It can feel random. It's generated by causes and conditions. This we know. Which causes and conditions, we don't always know. And so when we're really at that radical edge of the present moment, not lost in the past, not fantasizing about the future, these skills we've been cultivating, including discernment, they come into play, and awareness powers it. We can trust in awareness. Awareness holds this practice and this power. And so this path unfolds in its own way, in its own time. And the Buddha gives a really lovely image of it that I'd like to share with you. So this sutta, it's very brief. It's called Development. Development. It's in the from the Anguttara Nikaya 771, FYI. So the Buddha says, suppose a hen has 8, 10 or 12 eggs that she had not properly covered, warmed or nurtured. Then, even though this wish may occur to her, may my chicks break through the eggshells with the points of their claws or beaks and hatch out safely. Yet the chicks are unable to do so. Why is that? Because the hen has not properly covered, warmed or nurtured them. So too, when a person is not intent on development, even though they form the wish, may my mind be released from the taints by not clinging. Yet their mind is not released from the taints by not clinging. Why is that? Because they lack development. They lack development of what? The four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four bases of power, the five spiritual faculties, the five strengths, the seven factors for awakening, the noble eightfold path. So there's more, but what we have there are the Bodhipakya Dharmas, the kind of the set of sets of teachings of the Buddha. So by this point, the Buddha's developed his teachings have spread far and wide, and we have these different sets. We haven't covered all of these here at all. Some of you will know all of them, some of you will know some of them. But we've been cultivating the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and implicitly the five spiritual faculties. Those describe how we actually steady ourselves for cultivation of collectedness of mind. So we've been cultivating these through these weeks, and you have prior to coming here, and you will as you leave. So he starts with the bad news, then it gets more encouraging. But suppose a hen has 8, 10 or 12 eggs that she properly covers, warms and nurtures. Even though this wish may not even occur to her, may my chicks break through the eggshells with the points of their claws or beaks and hatch out safely. Even though this wish may not occur to her, yet the chicks are capable of doing so. Why is that? Because the hen has properly covered, warmed and nurtured them. So too, when a person is intent on development, even though they may not form the wish, may my mind be released from the taints by not clinging. Still, their mind is released from the taints by not clinging. Why is that? From development. Development of what, you may ask? The four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four bases of power, the five spiritual faculties, the five strengths, the seven factors for awakening, the noble eightfold path. And then we move into a different image now. Just as when a carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice sees the marks of their fingers or thumb on the handle of their axe, they do not know Today, my axe handle wore down this much. Or yesterday, it wore down that much. Or the day before yesterday, it wore down this much. Still, they know it is worn through. In the same way, when a person dwells, devoting themselves to development, they do not know, today my taints wore down this much. Or yesterday they wore down that much. Or the day before yesterday, they wore down that much. Still, they know that they are worn through when they are worn through. Mm. Often in this path, we notice development through what we lack, what we don't do anymore, don't we? You turn around and you think, oh, a year ago, if the same sort of thing happened, I'd probably have been a bit more reactive than I am now. Oh, something's softened, something's fading a little bit. Yeah? A few months ago, in a social setting, I might have been a bit more socially phobic. A little bit more self-conscious, but now look what's happening. Not even a sense of self, just a conviction about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and a kind of joy filling the body, filling the heart. Yeah. We can't really measure these things. We may notice our relationships are getting a little bit easier, more harmonious, or perhaps just more authentic, which they usually go together, those things. Just as the carpenter with the axe, you know, you can't see day by day something like that getting thinner and thinner, but you can see prints, can't you? I remember having the fortune of being in Notre Dame once in Paris a long time ago, and in this little grotto to the side was a statue of the Madonna of Mary, and leading to the Madonna were these stone steps, you know, about this high, two or three steps, and what struck me was that the sides, they were like this and then they went down like that. These stone steps, decades and decades and centuries of people kneeling down, bringing their tears, their sorrows, their hopes before the Madonna, and it had actually worn the stone down. Yeah. It's a very powerful place to be, that spot there, where concentrated adoration, really, and hope, aspiration. So just as when, and this is the last image here, just as when an ocean-going ship rigged with masts and stays, after 6 months on the water, is left on shore for the winter. Its stays, weathered by the heat and wind, moistened by the clouds of the rainy season, easily wither and rot away. In the same way, when a person dwells, devoting themselves to development, their fetters easily wither and rot away. A bit like the broken gong, the rotting away of things. It's a different kind of inspiration, isn't it? But that sense of the fetters rotting away, these fetters are like these ropes or these chains that bind us to a sense of self that keeps arising and passing, born and dying, born and dying. Selfing synonymous with suffering, and then over time we sit on the eggs of our practice. Yeah? Just keeping it warm, keeping the practice warm, keeping it warm through recollection, through the practices of the cultivations, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and so on. But also through cultivation of Sangha, through all of the different ways that we have to keep this practice alive, keep it going. Mm-hmm. Priming the heart and the mind, listening to the Dhamma, reading the Dhamma, bit by bit. The fetters wither away, vanish, disappear. It's not that we have to create something. It just needs to be set free. And this is what we're doing every time we cultivate awareness and bother to make the effort to see what's here right now and let it be. Let it go its own way. It's not us, it's not ours. Come out of the fight with everything, the need to control it, make it this way or that. But it's not all loss. We're not losing all that great entertainment of fantasizing now here, now there, angry thoughts. Better than not existing, is it? You know, it's not that we lose all of that. It's that we start to give our allegiance more and more to awareness, and awareness leads us all the way to the unconditioned. So the hen on her eggs, the carpenter with their hand on the axe, whatever image works for you of this cultivation. The carpenter isn't gripping the axe handle 24/7. The hand would go into paralysis. They'd maybe give up carpentry altogether. We modulate our practice. There are times for intensive sitting practice, times for retreat, times for doing more chanting, time for doing more walking meditation, time for more connection with Dharma friends. Time to give yourself a break. Let it be. And in community and in relationship with others, in relationship with the teachings, we each find our way with that. And we have different tendencies, different minds. There's no one way. So we trust ourselves first and foremost as we apply all the learning, like Indiana, everything we've got, to take the next step, one step at a time. And if I return to that dental chair for a moment, I wonder what it would be like if instead of a kind of creepy, psychedelic, sort of smug, gloating set of sea creatures, and there'd been some Dharma inscribed in the ceiling. I'm not imagining that ever happening, but just, you know, for a second, if coming into contact with and reflecting on reality moment to moment were what everyone did, what the dentist did, what the dental nurses did, what the people in their cars on the roads on the way home from the dentist did, what we did, what our friends, relatives did, it'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it? I mean, cool. As in the nervous system. Cool. It'd be very safe, wouldn't it? It'd be very conducive to living in a way that would bring freedom. So we can't ask it of the dentist and the dental nurses and the fellow motorists on the road, but we can give it. We can keep the practice going. That's a gift for ourselves right here and now, and it's a gift for those around us. And we see that in the relationships that we have that are getting less conflicted, little bit by little bit. Our relationship to ourselves, to the stuff that keeps coming and going through us. So we really need to take heart with this practice. Trust ourselves. Get support where we need it. And first and foremost, awareness comes first.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.